Back in session, continue meeting.
Like that.
The last item on our agenda today is the executive committee. We do have a quorum of our membership, members of the executive committee available. We have two action items on the agenda. Take up item number one with respect to approval of the addendum to the athletic employment contract of Jeffrey S. Rom. Entertain a motion.
So moved to approve the action item.
Motion by Region Johnson.
Second.
Second by Region Ridley. Questions or discussions? Barbara, excuse me, Region Burke.
First of all, I appreciate the fact that friends tell that we're going to have documentation of the additional compensation comes from the KUF. I think that's important at a time when there's not much money for anybody, salary increases. I have a question on the 505, I guess it's A, on the liquidated damages part. I guess I just need some help in understanding why the original contract would have been pretty generous in compensating the university if we lose the coach. It was like $1.5 million down to $600,000 life of contract. And now it's been reduced to $750,000 down to $300,000 that would be liquidated damages on termination without cause if the coach left.
Point of order, Mr. Chairman. I apologize, Barbara.
Yeah.
But, and I don't want to interfere with your question, but if we're talking specifics of a contract, I believe it involves personnel, then I don't think that should be in an open forum. I think that ought to be in a closed session because it involves A, a contract, and B, personnel. I'll look for Deborah. She's
right. I'm happy to do it any way you want, but I'm referring to the specifics that are on the motion.
Okay.
Well, in a nutshell, it actually starts at 900 and goes down to 300. But any contract negotiation is just that, a negotiation.
I'm sorry, Gary. I do think there has to be. I think we have to address the point of order.
Oh, I agree.
And I apologize.
Are you available to?
Yes.
Are you available?
You understand my question?
I don't think she heard it. Would you say it again?
Did you understand my question?
Yes, and I think you all can go into closed session.
Okay.
I'm sorry, I didn't.
She said yes?
Yes.
Then, Mr. Chair, I would move we go in closed session for the purpose of discussing personnel and their contract. Anything related to that.
Motion for closed session. We hear a second.
Second.
Second by Region Ridley. Committee members, any further discussion? All in favor of going into closed session for this particular topic? Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. So approved. We will now proceed into
And whoever you want to invite.
I would like Deborah and Clyde to remain closed.
Gary, I apologize.
I mean, you know.
I want to state for our minutes of record that we have now returned to open session. While in closed session, no official action was taken, and the matters discussed were limited to those stated in the motion to go into closed session. As a reminder, we were discussing action item executive number one with regard to the contract. And we now come back to the committee and ask if there are any other questions or discussions.
I just have a comment. First, I do want to commend the AD for getting external funding to cover the raise for Coach Rom. And again, I can't disagree with rewarding outstanding staff, or you will lose them. And that's the point. The message I've been trying to get across is, you know, as we faced nearly 22% turnover in staff positions last year across the whole university, it's unfortunate that we don't have the cheering fans every week. And when the faculty, you know, the staff are doing these recruiting efforts, and we've seen fine examples of retention that are efforts that are being carried on by the staff here at the university. And you know, they're going for it on fourth and goal, and they're making those big plays and the Hail Marys. But nobody's cheering them on every week, and nobody's, you know, we're not getting a million viewers on ESPN and things like that. But that doesn't discount that we're not doing great things at the university to support the academics and the academic goals and the retention and the students and the students' well-beings. So I applaud that they can, that athletics can recognize that they're going to lose somebody if they can't pay them fairly. I just hope we can find a path to do that for all staff at this university, because we are seeing that they are leaving. And anytime we have those positions vacated, there's issues and challenges that come with that that harm the overall infrastructure. But again, I would be hypocritical if I said this was not a good thing. I just wish that we can find, and I very much hope we can find a path for all the staff who are doing a good job.
Thank you, Ray.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Discussion?
I have a question.
Regent Birch?
It may be for Todd. I'm not sure, but whomever. It's obviously, we get a lot more publicity, and our university is known wider and broader as a result of our elevation to a different level of play. Not exact numbers or anything, but how would you describe what that has done in relation to our overall revenue generation and our expenses? In other words, I know it's more expensive, and I know we're generating more revenue, but is the revenue generation from it significant enough to merit also explaining the additional cost?
Well, I'm not sure I can completely know. Let me tell you what I think you asked for, and certainly if I don't touch on it, let me know. The first part of that, going into Conference USA and the success that we have had, the television package that they have has definitely increased our revenues from doing so. Candidly, unfortunately, they have been offset. Much of that growth has been offset by the reductions to our budget because of the state budget reductions and declining enrollment where the student fee is attached to it. So yes, going into Conference USA has increased our revenues, but we're essentially still revenue neutral because of what I just said.
So safe to say that the loss of monies through enrollment and state revenues in the base budget have pretty much equaled the additional amount of revenue coming in. So it's a wash. Okay.
I mean,
that's helpful.
Relatively so, yes.
Are there studies done which relate, like if a student is going to pick a university, picking a the winning athletic team versus one without? You know, I would think that because we have had so much success in football that we're going to generate more students because of that. I don't know if that has been studied, where we can put a definite, that's just my thinking.
I would agree, Melissa, and hopefully that's the case. I do know that a couple years ago, a school, Florida Gulf Coast, actually went to the Sweet 16 of the NCAA tournament and saw a big spike in their enrollment the following year. I don't know if it could be directly attributed to that, but it was probably more than coincidental. What I will have for you this summer when I do my presentation, our faculty athletic representative, Dr. Craig Martin, has a number of his students that are doing a project really analyzing the publicity side of what athletics is having in terms of our exposure in newspapers, the television, and kind of trying to equate a dollar figure, you know, to that, the amount of exposure versus if you were just to buy that, you know, if you were to buy an ad in a newspaper where there's a story, if you were to buy an ad on television where we're on, what that would equate to. So that might, you know, be interesting just in terms of, you know, it's not really a direct source of revenue in terms of the check, but there's certainly a lot of value in having a program in terms of the exposure that the overall university receives.
Dennison, I will say, I know anecdotally, and unfortunately I don't have the data to back it up, but in talking with students and talking with people who graduated from here, that many have said, you know, I came here because of athletics. They weren't playing athletics, but they came here because of the success that our athletics department was having. I know it's not a message that a lot of people want to hear, but it is true that athletics does have an impact on students coming and choosing this university.
Melissa, that what you bring up is among the most debated, and I won't say researched, but there have been a lot of studies, some affirming the suggestion that I think you're making and some discrediting such a suggestion. And it's all over the map in my 40-plus year career. That debate was just about as vibrating in the mid-70s as it is today. So, I mean, there's no definitive answer. The answer is yes, of course it does. The answer is, well, heck no, it doesn't. It just depends on your perspective and your point of view and what you want to believe it to be. But there is one thing that's for sure, and that is the visibility and the brand equity of a successful athletic program is real, and it is greater for us now than what it was in the Sun Belt, and it was greater in the Sun Belt than it was when we were in the Ohio Valley Conference. That's the reality of American higher education and the athletic dynamic. If we're going to, and the other factor is, all that's great to discuss, but the reality is much of our institutional history is steeped in athletic tradition, and most of our institutional traditions emanated from an athletic context in some fashion or other. The red towel, whatever. And so it's important here, and at least for the next 15 months. Because it's important to our alumni, it's important to this community, and it's an economic driver for this community, and we are here to drive the economy of this community. And it's important, and it's going to be, and I'll leave it up to you all to discuss that with my successor.
Anyone else? We have a motion and a second. We've had discussion. Call the vote. All in favor of approval of action item number one, aye.
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 Opposed, no.
No.
It's just executive. Right.
You can't vote, Barbara.
Was there any other, from the committee members, anyone in opposition? No. That I think we have unanimously approved by the executive committee. Pass it to the board. Next, move to executive action item number two, the athletic director contract.
Motion to approve.
Second.
Motion by Regent Ridley, seconded by
Second.
Regent Dennison. Call for questions and discussions. Hearing none, call the vote. All in favor of approval of executive action number two, aye.
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 Opposed, no. Passes. Recommendation passes to the full board. Next, we'll move into information items.
There's one that I would want to add to the agenda, and we can either do it first or last, but may as well go on because she's sitting right here. I know she's been watching her iPad, watching the House and Senate conferees, at least in the public portion of the conference session involving the leadership in the House and the Senate. So, Robin Taylor, I know it's a moving target, but give us a Frankfurt update right now as you speak and as you watch.
Well, I'm not watching right now. They actually just completed their, again, public discussion in the conference committee. What they do in the conference committee is they, you know, the House and Senate conferees and all the staff go in and they broadcast a portion of it, at least on the at the beginning. So they spent last night going through the differences of the budget. Today they're going through, I guess, more of the differences in more detail, and what they just completed their discussion on for now at this stage was the performance funding proposal from the Senate. I'll give you a little bit of detail on that in a second. But that's what I've been watching, that discussion, and that went on for, well over an hour. So they'll get back to all of that. At some point, I don't obviously know when that will be, but at some point they'll close the door, or the doors are closed, but at some point they'll turn the cameras off, they'll kick the media out, and they will get down to business. So what my colleagues and I will do is sit outside the doors and wait for them to come out and emerge like Oxytony Phil and let us know what the prediction is for the next 2 years. So this week on, I guess it was Monday evening, Tuesday, Wednesday, anyway, earlier this week, my days are beginning to run together. The Senate passed their version of the budget. So what I'm going to give you is just a quick kind of the comparison of the three budgets so you kind of know what our targets are. So the Senate budget included the governor's 9% budget cuts to universities. That also would include the 4.5% cuts in the current year. Those are not really mentioned, but they aren't not mentioned. So in the House budget, the House eliminated the 4.5% cuts with language saying you can't do that. Senate didn't do that, so they effectively stay, and they concur on the governor's 9%. House budget eliminated all cuts to universities. The Senate budget included a pretty complex and very detailed mechanism for a performance funding model, which the House budget only provided language, and that we would have a working group that would convene over the next year and come back with a report, and that the intent would be to begin performance funding in the next biennium. The governor's budget, as you know, provided for in the second year no particular mechanism for how we would get there, but in the second year they would take 33% of our funding for performance. And then he alluded to his intent to get to a 100% performance base, which is really just a redistribution of 100% of the base funding for universities by 2020. House rejected that outright. The Senate does something of a hybrid where they take 25% of our base budget in the second year, and they put that into a performance pool. The intent is that in perpetuity, that 25% of the current university base funding would be a kind of revolving performance pool from now on. So you protect 75% of your current base, and then you have 25% rolling forward every year that is up for grabs, so to speak. And then they have included a series of metrics, and most of them are based on the CPE metrics that we've already been involved in and agreed to much of the principle anyway. But the biggest, what I guess would consider, that we would all consider, the, you know, it's all of the fact that we're just learning about it, we don't know all the details, and we didn't have any input, those are obviously some concerns. And those are what's being discussed in the conference committee. And then the fact that there would be no ability to earn beyond your base money. So if they took, you know, the 25% they took from us, let's say we met all our metrics and we were the best of all the universities in our sector of comprehensive universities, we could earn back 100% of our 25%. I know that's very confusing. No other university could earn 100% of their money. So you create a pool then rolling forward of money that is kind of out there to be earned the next year. So if you didn't earn all of your money this year, next year you could earn your money back. In the next year out then, that money's up for grabs for everybody in this sector. So as you can see just from this, it's incredibly complicated and not something that, you know, that they seem, at least at this point, to all be on the same page about. So I think that ultimately we're going to have a lot of discussion in the conference committee about performance funding. I've probably given you way more detail than I should have, but it's important to know that this is the thing that I think they're really going to get into in the next few days, and it could have a huge, obviously, impact going forward. Can't predict what they'll do, but this is the big one. The Senate budget funds only a portion of the equity. You remember the governor provided an equity funding for WKU and NKU in the first and second years. The House took that out altogether. The Senate budget would fund half of it only in the second year. So they fund it, but they fund it only in the second year and only half. There are no capital projects in either budget, so our Gordon Ford College of Business is not included in none of the three budgets. And then agency bonds are not provided in the governor's budget. They are not provided in the Senate budget. Agency bonds, and that includes our parking garage, Jay Todd. Agency bonds are included in the House budget with language that basically says universities can do their own agency bonds. The Senate pulled that language out. I expect they'll at some point get to talking about agency bonds, but as of yet, nothing that we've seen. So as I kind of described to you a minute ago, I mean, they're going to, the plan now is they'll meet today. They have indicated they will not meet over the weekend. Feel sure some discussions will go on, but no formal meetings. They will come back and meet on Monday. Representative Overly just indicated a few minutes ago they intended to try to pass a budget out of conference, try to get it out of conference by midnight Monday. That seems ambitious, but that's their plan and what they would need to do in order to meet all the targets to get it ready for a vote on the floor by Wednesday. So I think that's the plan, is to try to get it out for a vote on the floor by Wednesday.
One postscript on the parking structure with Brian Kuster in the room. We are trying to secure language that would allow us to do a lease for a parking structure, which would then involve the Student Life Foundation. We might, and this is just a heads up to the board, it might require deeding property in that parking lot, the Creason parking lot, to the Student Life Foundation to build a parking garage using their debt capacity. And then the student fee flows to the university, and then the university, through a lease with the Student Life Foundation, then leases it from the Student Life Foundation in a lease arrangement rather than an agency bond scenario. So because of the fortuitous structure of the Student Life Foundation, we have a plan B, but it does require language, I guess, in the budget bill that...
No, we wouldn't have language in the budget bill. We would just have a line for a parking garage lease, and it's there.
Okay, and it is. So that's our, just in case you were wondering, we've already passed a student fee. The board's already approved this. CPE's approved it. Plan A and Plan B. Agency bond, Plan B would be a lease arrangement with the Student Life Foundation for that project, meaning that we still have every intent of being underway with that this summer.
They have a lot of big differences, but the two major differences in the House and Senate budget, and of course I've only really followed post-secondary, well not only, but mostly followed post-secondary, but the two biggest issues are performance funding and budget cuts to higher or to education. Because some of the 9% is across the board budget cuts in the executive branch, but they've been applied to education a little differently. So that's the big sticking point. The House didn't include budget cuts. They restored all that funding. The Senate did, and the governor did. So but I think it will come down to, I don't mean to speculate, but I think common discussion around is that two of the big things that will come down to the ultimate agreement or not is about higher education. Barbara?
I mean, did I hear you say that the university could get back if they got all of their performance money? Was the 25% they put in?
No. Okay, so I probably shouldn't have tried to get into. I've had less. What have we had? Less than 48 hours to really kind of understand this. Okay. So 100% of university-based funding is about $900 million. They are proposing in the Senate to take 25% of that. They would take 25% our base budget by the time they're done with cutting, and the Senate budget would be about $70 million, a little less than that. So they would take 25% of our $70 million, and we would have the ability to earn all of that 25% back. But we are going to compete with metrics against ourselves, so we would look at a four-year rolling average, and that would determine the baseline for your metrics. And then you would compete against the next year. So if you met all your targets, you could earn all your 25% back, and then you're basically held harmless other than the 9% cuts, okay?
So there's...
But no other institution can do it. So in any given sector, and it's divided by USA and UFL is one sector, comprehensives minus Kentucky State in another, and KCTCS is another. So let's just deal with our sector. Only one institution per sector can earn 100% of their money back. So the top performing institution gets 100% of their money back, and then everybody else is judged from there.
But your question is, what you're suggesting, you're exactly right.
Yeah.
The most you can do is get your money back.
No incentive. There's no incentive.
I read an article describing the U of L being in that sector, and the way that it was written said that meant, I mean, they made it sound like U of K or U of L, either one, could get part of the other's money.
Not the first or second year.
But later on?
Correct. And again, just listening to Senator Givens, who is the author of this, just listening to Senator Givens explain it in the conference committee discussion within the last hour, he indicated, okay, so you have year one, and you can earn all your money back or some portion. You have year two, where you whatever portion you didn't earn is still out there, so you can get it back. In year three, whatever's left goes into a pool, and then you can all compete for more.
In other words, so if you survive that long, by year three, you could theoretically get more money than the 25% you put in.
By year three, correct.
It's interesting because it's almost like a statement of we're wanting to fund higher education at all, but if you could prove the reason for your existence, we might let
that's
you stay.
That's exactly right.
I will just let that stand, as you all have stated. But to your point, Regent Ridley, yes, there is, and this is the point that President Ransdell made in our meeting with President Stivers and with Senate President Pro Tem Givens, is that, you know, you're basically providing us no incentive. There's no money beyond being able to get back. And their intent is the incentive is you're going to work really hard to keep the money you have. And they're also indicating that, well, you know, this works. Maybe we will put money in the future. And if we put money in the future, then there is more money for you to gain. And, I mean, but we're obviously dealing with a two-year biennium at this point. But, I mean, these are the issues that that are going to go forward in the next few days, and they're going to hash those out. I don't know where they'll come up with agreement. I mean, they had a lot of nice, you know, conversation back and forth about the work that's gone into this, and but you know, ultimately they're pretty far apart.
Can you educate us maybe and give us a little insight of why the agency bonds have been just completely ignored? I mean,
debt. Although
general debt.
General debt. Although the agency bond debt becomes our debt, it's still a part. It's still counted and calculated in the overall debt for the Commonwealth. Mm-hmm. So there's just an effort to not add any debt. And you've heard the governor mention that he didn't have much tolerance for debt. The Senate has indicated they didn't either. The House effectively deals with that by giving us language that we've actually been trying to get for some time that would remove the cap or the need for us to have in a budget bill agency bond authority and authority for cash projects. So all the things that we put in a budget bill, and Aaron from the Daily News and I've had some conversation about this, but we try to make a two-year assessment, actually a six-year assessment, but a two-year assessment of all the things that might come up that we might spend over $600,000 on. And if anything comes up differently than that, or if a project changes, we have no flexibility. So the House has attempted to give us that. We've talked to several members of the Senate who maybe are okay with the cash projects part, but not the bonding part. And ultimately, they just don't really want to give up control of that decision-making process.
You know, John, if you really wanted to be very paranoid about this, and maybe we should, you could suggest that the lack of funding of agency bonds is because you don't want to let universities obligate any more of their revenues, since you're planning to take so many of them away anyway.
I
mean, you are.
Yeah, I might not make that leap, but it really ultimately is. Well, I mean, there can't be anything more paranoid than me. But especially after 3 months in Frankfurt. But I mean, ultimately, it boils down to just who gets to authorize and have some control. And they don't want to give all of that control over to the institutions. I mean, that's the simplest version of that. We do have one bill that we've really worked hard on, and Jennifer Smith in my office has just been quite the bulldog. We've been working with all the institutions, but primarily with the University of Kentucky. And that's the distance education, we call it SARA bill, but it's the it's a bill that allows for interstate distance education to take place and would save us a lot of money. This is a big priority for DLO and for Beth Lavis. And we're right there. Bill's been passed in the Senate. Another bill passed in the House. The Senate bill is now through the process. It's on the consent order today to be passed on Monday. So we're crossing our fingers and hoping we can push that one over the finish line and at least come away with a win of some sort. And on a, you know, usually I stand up and tell you we've tracked 200 or 300 bills, and these are five things that are moving. We've tracked a lot of bills. The SARA bill is really the only one that has a deep impact for us that we're really working on. Legislative-wise, hadn't been a huge amount of stuff coming our way. A lot of stuff got dealt with kind of early and went away, and so most of what we spent our time on is the budget. And I got to just say thanks to President Ransdell, who has given us time pretty much every week to be in Frankfort. We've had him up there meeting with legislative leaders and with the governor several times, the governor and the governor's staff throughout this process. So, I mean, he's been as engaged as anybody could be in trying to get us to a point of, unfortunately, zero budget cuts. For 10 years, all we've really done up there is play defense and try to keep what we have. I'm sad to say that that's really where we remain, is trying to keep what we have. Making progress has not been part of the game the last several years.
Any unfunded liabilities that we're going to be addressed with this next round?
I don't think so. You mean tuition waivers?
Yeah.
No. Some suggested, but they didn't
hit.
Make it very far.
That's what I meant when I said things got dealt with early.
I see.
On the SARA bill, the reason that's important is for our distance learning program is we pay fees to receive students to take online courses in other states. We pay fees to those states. And so this is would allow us to avoid paying those fees, but allows those students to come here.
It's called the State Authorization Reciprocity Agreement, and it's a reciprocal agreement between states. It's a national agreement that of the southern region states, the SREB states, Kentucky's the only state that hadn't yet signed on to the national reciprocity.
Your students can come here and take online courses. Our students can go to your state and take online courses, the institutions in your state. So it's a reciprocity agreement. Right now we're paying close to $500,000 a year in fees for us to enroll students in other states in our online courses. This would allow us to avoid that.
It goes a little bit beyond even that. I mean, that's the big issue, but the smaller issue, I mean, we can't do things like put a billboard in Tennessee, for example, because we're not, because it indicates presence. And so those are some of the things. The federal government got involved in this a few years ago and complicated things a little bit. But so it's just important that we get this accomplished. And again, 34 other states have done this. Kentucky is the lone remaining state in the southern region. We think it'll make it.
Am I understanding correctly that Kentucky state is exempted from this performance?
Kentucky state is exempt from the performance funding methodology, the whole performance model. They did exempt Kentucky state, recognizing the disadvantages that this might put them in, given their current financial situation and some of the challenges that they are facing. And so they have given Kentucky State the land grant match that they must have for their federal land grant and exempted them from the performance funding in an effort to basically keep them home.
It's a challenge, and it'll run its course in the next few days.
It'll be different by Monday.
Now, before we get into these last two agendas, thank you, Robin.
Okay.
Any more questions, Robin? I'm sorry. Just understand, once we know what the final budget is, assuming there's a budget, and if there are cuts, then we've got a pretty short window to deal with it. Now, we've been working at it for the last couple of months, and we've been working at it, and I have, and we've been fairly under the radar on that because we did not want the debate to turn to debating things on our campus that might be cut as opposed to the legislature's focus on the cuts themselves. Because if we'd have sent a signal that we're already debating it, then their interpretation would be, well, they're already well into it. See, I told you they could handle it. So, point is, the last 2 weeks in April, I would predict, will be very difficult. Because then we will have to implement cuts, and it will mean program elimination. We are not going to do an across-the-board approach. We've been doing that for 10 years now with cuts consistently, and we have a number of programs, departments, divisions on this campus that have the capacity to absorb an across-the-board cut because most of their operating budget is little or nothing. So we will identify specific programs for elimination to include job loss. I just want this board to understand what we'll be dealing with, and we'll come back to you and you'll approve, well, you'll be presented a budget, and that will be the final approval of those actions. We can't wait until June to make decisions and implement and take action. So I'll keep you posted as best we can, but it's going to be a very difficult couple of weeks if these cuts, in fact, are handed down after the state budget is final. But it's just, I want everybody to be aware of the dynamics and the difficulties that lie ahead. Brian.
Talk about a tough one to follow.
Good news, well, we got a new science building going up.
Good afternoon, and wanted to bring up we're going to highlight today the Ogden College Hall project that has actually under contract. It's gotten started. It's located on the Ogden College Science and Engineering campus. And you see kind of just a highlight of the area. One of the projects, it really has three components. It's a multi-phase project that has started in 2016, but it encompasses a new science building. It has some structural work that's being done on the planetarium, and also some components and renovation of Thompson Complex Center Wing. These pictures that have been taken are actually taken with a drone that one of my employees has personally purchased and registered and followed the new rules and regulations of several agencies, but he had enough interest in it but it has created some really nice photos for us. But the project actually started underway. Wittberg Construction, who completed the Downing Student Union project for Western, started in February, actually breaking ground, setting up, and you can see the trailer and the site and actually starting into the footers. This new building is the first phase, about $32 million of a $48 million state agency funded project, which is very nice. This building is predominantly nothing but classrooms and laboratories. So we have 36 laboratories going to be used by chemistry, physics, and biology. Got a 300-seat auditorium, which they'll use for large. This is also taken with a drone, and I thought we'd share that just for add a little feature to the where we could actually get close. Fascinating, but they're actually starting to do the foundation footing for the project. When it's completed, it'll really enhance the Ogden campus. With a new building. It's interconnected to a new building, a relative new building, which is Snell Hall. They'll be able to cross over from one building to the other without going exterior. And I think it's going to be a great improvement and a recruitment tool because we're replacing a building that was built in 1960. And it was pretty tired. It had not changed since I've been to school. People have told me it didn't change since they've been to school. So it really, this is going to be a very state-of-the-art project that's going to be added for that growing campus. And this renovation, we call this an iconic structure. It's our Hardin Planetarium, built in 1967. We've got some delamination and things on the outside of the building. We are taking, I'm going to say, sections, budgeting a certain amount of money for the planetarium to do structural work. Move forward, we'll be able to add to it. This is not being done under the Wittenberg construction contract. We've actually gone out and taken the documents, gotten a bid, and we're actually going to do this work this summer. And we'll get the exterior portion of the building completed, coordinating that effort with the Department of Astronomy, because they'll actually be using that facility. Thompson Complex Center Wing is the final phase of the project that we'll be doing, because we're using that 117,000 square foot facility as swing space. And we've really put a lot of, I mean, it is 100% full. But once the new building is completed, which they're going to call Ogden College Hall, they will move those departments and labs that are still existing in predominantly the fourth floor of Thompson Complex Center Wing. Part of the project that we have, which is a major, this building again was built in 1967 along with the planetarium, is the roof is 100% gone. I mean, it is dilapidated to the point, and you can see how busy it is, that we would, if it didn't have a concrete deck, we'd have a lot of water actually going into that building. But most of these items on the top of this roof actually will go away, because the laboratories on the fourth floor will be taken out, and most of what you see in ductwork is because of ventilation hoods, and all of the labs are actually getting moved back over to the new facility. So we'll totally renovate the fourth floor of this facility, and then the final completion for this project will be August of 2018. Open for any questions that someone might have.
Looks perfect. Completion date. Completion date for the building?
The first building, it'd be, I think it was January 2017.
Not January, December.
December, excuse me. Ready for.
I'm pretty impressed if you're going to have it ready by January 17th.
Brian, as a point of reference, can you share with the board when that project actually was, when the concept was started?
The master plan for Ogden College was 2005, which many components that dominoes that have taken place on the campus of the science campus. It was the number one priority for Western Kentucky University, and we made a decision. We tore down, we built the new Snell Hall. We built the EST building, Environmental Science and Technology building, EBS, excuse me.
Engineering and Biological Sciences.
We renovated totally, I think in 2009-10, the, I used to call it Science and Technology Hall, but we call it College High Hall now, which is mathematics predominantly. So there's been a domino effect that we've had on that campus. And it had been our, from 2005, our number one priority project.
Back in fall of 97, when I first went to every department on campus, just taking an assessment of needs and problems, clearly our science facilities were our greatest need from a facility standpoint in terms of deterioration, just problems facilities-wise. And we put a kind of a master list together and a long-term plan, and this building, the planetarium, we finish the renovation of the center wing, we'll finally finish up the addressing needs for the science, for Ogden College of Science and Engineering. And it's taken 20 years. But it's gone in several different phases. The engineering building, Snell Hall, College High Hall, this building, and in between a lot of small things in between, planetarium. But it's all part of that plan that started, and you know, it's been frustrating that we haven't been able to move all that along. But by the time all is said and done, I guess you could kind of add the projects up. But I'm just going to throw a number, $150 million in work and on the science campus over that period of time. So it takes time and persistence.
Thank you.
Final report, we have the final enrollment figures for Brian Meredith. You'll come up. We have the final enrollment figures for the spring, and now we turn our attention, Dr. James Lux and his staff have their attention turned to recruiting for this next fall for quite some time now, but in terms of just the data collection, close the book on spring 16, and Brian will kind of give us a report on that and kind of what we're looking at for fall 17. Sure. Excuse me, fall 16.
What's floating around to you is the standard enrollment report you see. And it's been good today. If there was ever a theme in the board meeting, it seems retention was that theme. So that's very helpful in framing a lot of the things that are going on in EEM and academic affairs, student affairs, and across campus. But what you see before you is the spring enrollment report. By the way, we always seem to land near or on the census date, which was late yesterday. So this data was pulled earlier this week, but it varies very little from what IR cleans up and sends on to CPE in the coming days. We are, for this spring 16, at 18,566. I joke mainly about in the fall to Regent Higdon to plus or minus 2%, but we're at 1.7% there with that number. But I really mean that for the fall more than anything, Freddie. So, but that kind of maintained from what I'd predicted a little bit. As you fall down, it's each of the breakdowns and categories and ethnicity, underrepresented minority, holding well. Where it says international, that really should say international non-resident alien. That needs to be retitled in the chart. Maintaining with our international enrollments overall in state, so that has some pluses there as well as out of state. Again, that trails and follows what the missions team is doing, not only within the Commonwealth but outside in the region and out of region recruiting. Which is kicking in pretty aggressively. Jason, his team are, you know, always in the footprint here at South Central Kentucky in the Southeast, but they're all over the coast these days recruiting. As you go to the right side there, again, trending down through gender level of undergraduate and graduate classifications, full-time, part-time, you're seeing under the classifications a slight dip there in freshmen and sophomore, but that kind of washes out with the uptick in juniors at 162. Plus. And then high school enrollments, those would be dual credits. This I would note again, and the president has mentioned this, but in the fall and this spring, we've seen historic dual credit enrollments and working that group very aggressively to turn those into full-time students with us in the fall and build that relationship. And there's a whole litany of activities that admissions is doing with dual credit to make sure that that happens. Masters, doctoral, all these different areas here, you see some pluses in our graduate enrollment as well, and particularly graduate international enrollment, but graduate enrollment overall is doing quite well. Traditional and non-traditional, the non-traditional negative 159, that's again students going back to work, choosing work over school, which is not an uncommon phenomenon or not something we hadn't mentioned before. If you flip the report over, first-year students, that's a little more meaningful in the fall. Most of your, you know, first-year students begin with us in August, not in January. Transfers holding their own. Again, the transfer center is doing well, not only recruiting but advising and bringing those schools in through KCTCS. And we're doing a lot of out-of-state, again, recruitment with admissions, Kentucky 4 years as well. And that's no small feat. The transfer center was a positive move WK implemented a couple of years ago, and KCTCS and the two-year schools in Kentucky have some challenges, but we've been able to maintain a flow of enrollment from those institutions, and I personally believe that's because of those joint admissions agreements and relationships we started a number of years ago with the dynamics and conversations with the students in the community colleges. Always like to list the top five transfer institutions just to give you a kind of a litmus test of where they're coming from within Kentucky. South Sky CTC, as you'd imagine, would be, it always maintains, you know, some of the highest levels with us. And then international categories, direct admit, ESLI, folks that move out of ESLI into fully with us, as well as our WKU pathways and completers as well. And you'll see a little dip there in Glasgow, but some of that's with the part-time and part-time enrollments there. But Glasgow's working with that, and Dr. Brad Kissel's working with that team. On the right side, we don't have it not normally historically given you this information, and I think it's appropriate with all the conversations regarding retention this morning. But you see the fall to spring persistence rates by classification. Classifications at the bottom underneath all degree seekers, first time, first year, other, which would be just other students in those categories, seniors, and then we added graduate. We haven't added graduate in the past to looking at some of the persistence rates. And then that bottom right, the graph is first time, full time, baccalaureate. Much of our cohorts, which we're graded on with CPE, and so many things are set in motion based on those cohorts. Again, the spring is a different dynamic. It's a different animal than fall. We've continued to work with our students on being very creative and understanding as they pay their tuition bills and address the financial challenges there before them. We get better with that actually each semester, giving them more time and settling those bills. And I think that could not happen if we didn't have the financial aid people, ANS folks, and business and finance with the bursar, and EM all working on that together to be student friendly in those regards. We've talked about retention academically, but financially there's retention components as well, and that's something that EM and business and finance are leading the way on. So that's kind of sort of some of where we are with the enrollment report.
Are these the final numbers?
No, these are not. These are preliminary, but they shouldn't deviate much from this. They were pulled a few days ago, or actually IR pulls those on Saturday before the week we go into. They froze everything last night, yesterday, for the census. The census was yesterday, so they would have the final numbers to go to CPE in the coming days. But we don't believe it's going to deviate much from this.
About 70 is what we're thinking. About the change of 70 students. We had some cleanup yesterday, so I took a sneak peek.
Up or down?
Down.
70
down from the number that you saw up there. It was
70 from the 8 off of the 18,566.
From that 315.
Quick summary as we take a snapshot for the fall.
The fall, looked with admissions and IR data, which is all the same, but we are up. First of all, it's very early. ATP is now referred to as top, or if you will, orientation, where students come and are advised and registered. The first one will be April 15th. Normally we've started those in later March, and we have some very deliberate reasons when we had Render and some other kind of experts coming in and talking to us, and they said begin those in April, thus April 15th. But anyway, right now, as of yesterday, applications were up about 700 applications. Admitted about 900, both of these 900 more students. And if you break that down, just very preliminary, again, this is very early. The increases in applicants and admitted students, Kentucky students, were up, about 370 more apps, and TIP residents, up about 250 apps, and 165 positive with the military resident rate. So that's just, again, it's very early for that. Now the next step in that, you say, well, okay, that's great, but where do we go from there? The yielding, to getting those students to matriculate and show up in the fall. The admission staff is one, they're hosting yielding events throughout the, all the way up until August, and then put into motion this year. Well, last year they put in quite a few yielding activities, and then again this year they're going to host six Saturday and Sunday afternoon welcome to WKU picnics throughout the Commonwealth, and where admissions counselors, alum, and different areas across territories would be invited, kind of like the kickoff parties you'd see that many institutions do, but they'll be regionally held. A lot more direct mailing to parents and students that we hadn't done in the past. Parents are extremely involved in this decision process, as you may imagine. 77% of our parents and guardians, according to a recent study regarding students, 77% weigh in on that and really put their thumb on that decision. So we're going to mail to the families a Hilltopper family red towel to the parents of all those admitted students with communications from admissions, president, and different places like that, amongst just holding the picnics and activities in addition to ATP, what formerly was ATP or TOP. Got to get my new nomenclature correct. And then, as Ransdell said, there's over 1,000 students and families and guests here with us today, which is pretty good, juniors and seniors, for a spring event. So right now, I mean, the admissions office, the energy's heading in the right direction with admissions. It's very competitive spirit, a go-after-it, go-getter spirit, and kind of you're seeing it slowly trend with freshman and transfer numbers. The new frontier, or the ever-growing frontier for us, has been outlined all morning, is retention, and that's where a great deal of our energies and efforts and resources are moving into. Fifth week assessment, I just want to say some positives there. That's a retention tool that we've been doing now for probably 10, 12 years or so, maybe longer. There was the highest participation rate in fifth week assessment, where faculty can identify students who are in, you know, academically in trouble, not attending class, needing assistance. And we expanded that to sophomores this year into 200 level courses. And wasn't sure how that would be, but the faculty responded very well to that and got some, you know, pretty early feedback so our academic advisors could go in there and do some intervention. So I just mentioned that as just one of many pieces to the retention initiatives to try to turn that ship around. That's a thumbnail sketch of what's going on at yielding events, and then this spring, other questions or concerns, or yes, Regent Birch.
I have two or three questions. One, I noticed a pretty good bump in our graduate students this year. Now I know a little bit of that, maybe 25% of it is new doctoral programs. Mm-hmm. But that's a pretty significant bump. Mm-hmm. What do you attribute it? What happened?
Well, I mean, the one, the much of that is with some domestic, a good, great deal international. Dr. Eric Reed has worked very closely with the colleges and departments and units to understand, this is just my opinion on that, that, you know, that we've got to be proactive and timely and turn files around very quickly. You know, graduate students, particularly in master's degree programs, they could be turned around quickly, letting the faculty weigh in. Those are just some of my initial comments why that's happened. And a great deal of that is international, but some is domestic, and Dr. Reed is doing a nice job in shepherding that through.
Last, I guess it was last year, budget time, we approved a special tuition rate for people in the graduate programs in teacher ed who were pursuing certification. Mm-hmm. Is that any portion of it? Did that help? Did it not help?
For spring, I would say probably limited so, but for fall possibly, so it may be early there, and Dean Evans is looking into that. It's a good initiative. Part of the problem is that many of the other institutions, particularly online and otherwise, have gotten out there on that, out ahead of the ball. But I mean, it's a good start, but Dean Evans would have to tell us further where that is. I don't know that you're seeing a lot of that in this spring. You might see that in the fall.
Might be good to know that as we come into the next tuition period. One more question. The Herald had an article, I guess on last month or something, noting that the, I'm looking at international enrollments, which are down a little bit, and noting that the Saudi government announced cutting funds from the Abdullah Scholarship Program, potentially affecting populations here, and our faculty says that we have 594 students, making up 42.4% of the international population, 485 of them degree-seeking. My question is, what is the outlook? What are we doing here? We're very fortunate to have that Saudi oil, but with the price of oil and all the other things happening, the picture on the wall says that we ought to be looking at what we're going to do as those numbers likely decline. And that's a pretty significant piece of our enrollment. Could you talk a little bit about
it? Send that around, Barbara. That's
this is it. Okay. That's called psychic.
All right.
Or advanced warning, whichever.
It's top of mind, and this document addresses a great deal of that, Dr. Birch.
Bottom line is we're tracking it very closely. Actually, Roz and I both did an interview with the New York Times this week, and I think it would be quite a positive article about our internationalization. The King Abdullah Scholarship, there's a lot of speculation with the price of oil being down, less investment in those scholarships. We've received no official notification. We'll track it closely. We're not going to overreact. We believe that a lot of our Saudi students could pay their own way if they had to. They come with wealth. They may be here because of the King Abdullah Scholarship, but they're capable of staying here on their own if need be. That's not universal, but we think that's the case with many of them. We'll take this a semester at a time. In the meantime, we're working hard across the Middle East, but Pacific Rim, India, other places, to develop new cohorts, new populations, new governmental contracts that will send cohort populations to us. It's a constantly moving target. The one thing that is reality in the international marketplace is change. Geopolitical, economic, it's all over the map, and what works for you this year, probably is not going to work for you next year, and you better be fluid and flexible and have your tentacles out and be ready to replace one population with another, and that's just simply the reality. So our challenge this year is to stabilize our international enrollment for next fall. But for fall of 17, I'm hesitant to throw a number out, but I want a dramatic increase in international enrollments going into the fall of 17. And I think we're positioning ourselves to do just that. Our goal this fall is stabilization and maintaining that 1,500-ish international student population. Roz, I was looking over there. You're sitting over there with a while ago. Roz is right here. But we're on it. We're tracking it. And I'm confident that we're positioning ourselves for a growth mode in international enrollments. But you got to roll with the flow, and you got to change and adapt and not get too caught up in the global politics. But they do dictate often what countries are able to do, particularly if governments are funding students coming from that country. Roz, anything else?
Absolutely. I guess this document kind of covers a lot of it, and some consistently with the scholarship program is that nothing in writing really actually happens. So whatever policies they put in place, they're very savvy in not implementing those until they know how the students are going to react to it. So they put a policy in place, wait a year, and then see how it works, and then so anything that they're putting out right now, we're monitoring it carefully, but we know that that's going to change very significantly.
Roll the flow, be prepared, change and adapt, and mm-hmm. keep your target focused and grow your populations. I mean, that's basically our international strategy, and we're working with agents across the globe. And,
comment. I think I know that a lot of efforts are being made by everybody on campus on enrollment, and when you look at where the students are, aside from internationals, I mean, we know the numbers are not, they're not as many coming in the pipeline, and so it's obvious that retention, and I've heard you say this, Gary, retention is where it's got to be, and seems to me as we, even with budget cuts as we go into that, we've got to put significant resources behind retention. That's just where we've got to put it.
I agree. I absolutely agree. And we're beginning to take pages out of books that other institutions are employing and learn what we can, but it's very frustrating to lose 25% of the freshman class by their sophomore year. You know, we deal with, and that gets a little frustrating sometimes in Frankfurt when they talk about performance funding and the like. But when you have 4,000 freshmen, many of them come, they're not as well prepared as others in the class. They come because they got some keys money, they maybe get a little financial aid, they realize that, I don't know if I can do this, a girlfriend's back home, they get a job at the Ford plant, whatever the case might be. There are a lot of reasons why we lose freshmen. And the more we can grow our out-of-state enrollment and our international enrollment, the better we're going to do with retention, because those students are here for a purpose. They're generally paying a lot more money, and they're more likely to graduate. So our enrollment strategies are also aimed at growing our retention rates with populations that we know persist and graduate at a higher rate. Another factor that's worth noting.
Is Robin still here?
Robin. Another factor that's worth noting is in the House budget was a community college provision that was a top it off concept to make community college free for Kentuckians. The state would pay for whatever financial aid or keys money or whatever it didn't cover. And if that should come to pass, and we don't know whether it will or not yet, but if it should come to pass, that will put great pressure on enrollments at four-year campuses. Tennessee implemented the Tennessee Promise Program for free community college, and the enrollments dropped between 5 and 10% on most four-year campuses. And that's the irony of a performance funding model that's based on growth. If it's implemented alongside a community college dynamic that will take students away from the four-year campuses, then you got two legislative dynamics that are completely in conflict with one another. So there's a lot of things in play right now. And none of us know right now what will be there this time next week yet. And so that's why it's very frustrating, but there's so much at stake with what is transpiring on the political front in recent weeks and days. So those are just some of the, there's not much more you can say about that, but that community college proposal, while having merit, has significant consequences and implications as well. So, it's all part of that. It's all part of the dynamic that we're dealing with. And so all these things we're talking about here all kind of blend together to produce the sheet that Brian just distributed. The Indian Project, we did this last year, a lot of controversy. But it's largely why those graduate numbers are up. So, there's just so many variables in play.
We entered into a very positive, speaking of community colleges, with Jefferson Technical Community College this week, another joint admissions, if you will. And those really long-term, they're already paying off, you can see it. Over time, they'll continue to do so. And it helps us have advisors and counselors and folks building relationships in those institutions. And the energy Wednesday was just so, so very positive with the two-year school.
It's not totally off the wall, but when you look at the free community college piece and even what's happening in Tennessee, and then you look at the proposal here, and you look at the differences in the retention rates of four-year universities from two-year colleges, giving education free to increase the economic outcomes is great if you're retaining the students. So much more beneficial to the state and all of the campuses, two-year and four-year, if that two-year, whatever it is, Robin, could be somehow dedicated to what it takes to have retention at any one of those institutions. Otherwise, we're just putting more free money into people. Mm-hmm. Yep. Dropout rates even higher.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right. That's a lot of philosophy going on right there.
I just think we've had enough today.
Yeah. We shall see you again soon.
You will.
Anything else on executive? Now we've concluded the executive committee agenda. Today's agenda. Remind everybody next Friday, 8 o'clock.
7:30.
7:30 breakfast, 8 o'clock meeting.
You're eating, don't you?
I do.
Okay.
7:30.
At the alumni.
Yes.
Obviously, alumni.
I guess I'll
we are